I think that we'll get started. My name is Dr. Lori LaFell. I'm a pediatric endocrinologist, epidemiologist, and clinical investigator at the Jaws and Diabetes Center in Boston, where I head the pediatric clinical and research program. And it is a pleasure to be here today and to moderate this afternoon's press briefing about the ADA-JDRF symposium. This symposium will examine numerous issues surrounding type 1 diabetes, including when and how this type of diabetes begins and develops and progresses, as well as some management issues around the globe. The embargo for this symposium is today, June 21st, at 4:15 Central Time. The symposium will take place at 4:15 in room S100B and will go until 6:15. Today, joining us on this esteemed panel is Dr. Jay Sasanko at my far right, your left. He is a professor of medicine and epidemiology at the University of Miami. To his left is Dr. William Hagopian, a lead researcher, scientific director of the Pacific Northwest Diabetes Institute, and a clinical associate professor of medicine at the University of Washington. They're in different order. Dr. Hagopian, raise your hand so people know and get the right name and face. Now, to Dr. Hagopian's right is Jaco Tumuleto, who is the Emeritus Professor of Public Health at the University of Helsinki in Finland. And to my immediate right is Dr. John Yudkin, who is the Emeritus Professor of Medicine at the University College in London and Chairman of the International Insulin Foundation. As you will soon hear, the ADA-JDRF Symposium will discuss new tools that have been created for the accurate prediction of who is at greatest risk for the development of type 1 diabetes, so that there will be new possibilities for the early intervention and potential greater preservation of beta cell function. The symposium will also examine the difficulties those patients and those afflicted with type 1 diabetes face in low-income countries in gaining access to affordable treatments, as well as some of the challenges that researchers face in trying to collect global data on the epidemiology of type 1 diabetes. Before beginning the presentations, I do want to let you know that this session is being audio taped, and we have some journalists who may be attending remotely by phone. It is for that reason that I remind people, and our presenters in particular, that it is important to speak into the microphone so that those journalists on the phone can hear all of the comments. For those on the phone, if you have any questions to ask of the presenters, please let your operator know by pressing star 1 on the telephone keypad, and we will, as time permits, do our best to answer your questions as well. One final housekeeping note is that we will entertain questions and answers after each of the presenters has had a few minutes to summarize their forthcoming presentations at this ADA-JDRF symposium for later this afternoon. Let me begin by introducing our first speaker, who is Dr. Jay Sasanko, again, Professor of Medicine and Epidemiology from University of Miami. And he will be speaking at this symposium on metabolic markers of type 1 diabetes using evidence from two very important studies, the Diabetes Prevention Trial Type 1 and the ongoing TrialNet study. Thank you, Jay.
Can you hear me? Yeah.
Yes, very good.
So if I talk too long, you'll give me the hook, right? So I'm going to speak about predictors of type 1 diabetes and specifically metabolic predictors such as glucose and C-peptide, which is a sort of similar to insulin in terms of what it means physiologically. So what I'm going to speak about is based on two studies, as Laurie said. One is the Diabetes Prevention Trial Type 1, which has been completed for a number of years now. But there's a wonderful database available from that study that has provided some wonderful information about the natural history and prediction of type 1 diabetes, and an ongoing study that's called TrialNet, which is a consortium of investigators from all over the world that are we're looking at ways of possibly delaying the onset of type 1 diabetes. And one of the parts of that study is called the Natural History Study, but that's been called the Natural History Study, but now it's called the Pathway to Prevention Study. And the Pathway to Prevention Study has accrued a wonderful, again, data set, which has provided an opportunity to look at the prediction of type 1 diabetes. So with the information from DPT1 and TrialNet, we've been able to develop a what's called a risk score based on certain characteristics of patients, including C-peptide as, levels and glucose levels, age, and body mass index. And we've been looking at whether it can improve the accuracy of prediction. And beyond that, I'm also going to speak about the possibility that we might be able to use one that we've developed, to use something like that to find a threshold that might be high enough that might be actually indicative that someone inevitably is going to get diabetes. Now, I can't say we know that for sure. We haven't necessarily can't say that we've accomplished that. But we would like to identify people earlier on during their progression to diabetes before the diagnosis, because if we can capture them earlier, they'll have hopefully more insulin available, and we can possibly treat them at an earlier stage of the disease process.
Thanks, Jay. Any questions from the audience? And if you have questions, please raise your hand and someone from the ADA will give you a microphone. Any questions? Maybe while people are thinking a question, I have one, Jay. Could you share with the audience about how many patients have contributed data in both DPT1 as well as TrialNet or Pathways to Prevention so people can understand the wealth of knowledge of information that leads to the ascertainment and derivation of this risk score?
Well, there was approximately 100,000 individuals who were screened to be in DPT1, and they were screened for the presence of autoantibodies, which are precursors to the diagnosis and predictors, actually, of diabetes. Among those 100,000, approximately, if I recall, about 3.5% were autoantibody positive, but it turns out that a total of about 711 to be exact, actually participated in these ongoing trials in DPT1. And TrialNet, to my knowledge, well over 100,000 have already been screened, and there are numbers, several thousand have been followed.
Thank you. I have a question in front of your name and where you're from.
Lynn Peterson from Trends in Medicine. So the bottom line is you don't have a predictive yet, or you do?
I don't want to be overly optimistic, but I think we've improved our prediction, our ability to predict type 1 diabetes. I think a risk score has shown that it's accurate relative to some other measures, and I think we have, I think, improved prediction. We're looking to improve it even further.
But is it enough to act on at this point? Is this something where we could see new guidelines? Is this ready for prime time?
I think that's for the medical and diabetes research community to decide. I think that I'm going to present data that I think is somewhat provocative, possibly, because it's sort of looking at the diagnosis of diabetes in another way. Type 1 diabetes is based on different kinds of criteria for the diagnosis. Some are overtly clinical criteria, like what's called diabetic ketoacidosis, where it's an open and shut case that someone has a disease. If you follow people with oral glucose tolerance tests, which is what we've done in DPT1 and TrialNet, and you follow them periodically, say, specifically every 6 months in those studies, you see that the glucose is gradually increase over time, and eventually they reach a certain level. And presently, we use criteria when the glucose goes over a certain level, and again, specifically, it would be greater than 125 for a fasting glucose and greater than 200 or greater for a 2-hour glucose. Those criteria, though, have been based on pretty much on adult data and on data from and also data relating to when complications of diabetes start to occur. So that might not be relevant or fully relevant to children with type 1 diabetes. So this is looking at the diagnosis possibly, and it's not replacing criteria that are set, but possibly helping to increase the to make the diagnosis at an earlier time.
And I think your very good question may be also answered by Dr. Hagopian when he gives a few of his statements. I think it was a great question. I saw another hand up.
Hi, Christina Fiore with MedPage Today. I was just wondering if you could expand on some of that data that you mentioned, or if we're going to get it from someone else later. I don't know if they're related or not, but if you had some specific numbers on like the predictive value of the tool or anything like that, that would be fantastic.
Well, I'm going to give the talk. It's very hard to just talk about specific data without a context, because I have to talk about the data populations that we studied. The population in TrialNet and DPT1 is mostly people who are children and adolescents. Some are young adults, but I can say that that based on the data that we've followed, that once people achieve a certain threshold of, say, the risk score, and this has been published, actually, that there's a very high likelihood, even with further follow-up within TrialNet or DPT1, that they will ultimately get the disease. I have specific numbers, but I'd rather sort of hold off until, but I can say it's based on the data itself, it's highly likely that once you pass a certain threshold, you're going to get the disease within a relatively short time.
Jay, if I could just reword maybe the question, is by identifying this risk score allowing you to have a lead in terms of months or years of identifying diabetes? Because the earlier you can identify high risk for diabetes, right, the greater residual beta cell
right
function. So if you
right
could just say months or years,
I can say within 2 years, say, you know, you can say that people are very high risk for getting the disease.
So that's a huge increase in the lead time. One more question, then we're going to move on.
Caitlin Heidemann, the Danish Diabetes Association. I wonder, could you elaborate a little bit about what benefits the individual patient would have of knowing I will at one point get
diabetes? That's a great question. Because right now, I think if, in fact, people want to start using, risk scores and that sort of thing, and it's possible there'll be other risk scores that'll be developed that will even be more accurate, I think that right now it could be used in a research context, and it has a real could be a big help in research, because if you know people are going to get diabetes earlier, then you can shorten studies. You would shorten the inconvenience for participants in the trials, and you could save research dollars. So that's clear if you could use it. Now, from a clinical standpoint, that's a whole new ballgame, because you have to consider other factors. For example, right now we don't have a really good intervention to prevent progression to diabetes, not one that's, could be used clinically at this point. So that's and the question is, then why would you necessarily clinically want to make an earlier diagnosis if you have nothing, if you don't have something to treat it with? And then the other consideration, then there are other concerns. You want to label someone with a disease earlier, and if you have nothing for them. But that's not to say that we're pessimistic. And that's what TrialNet's all about. We're looking to develop treatments that would be beneficial and might help to delay or prevent the disease. And if we could do both, diagnose the disease at an earlier stage and find treatments that would be beneficial at that stage, then it would be great.
So I think we're going to go to the next speaker, and additional questions can follow. It's my pleasure to introduce Dr. William Hagopian, who is the lead researcher, scientific director at the Pacific Northwest Diabetes Institute, and he's a clinical associate professor at the University of Washington. At the symposium this afternoon, he will be speaking on a public health model for general population screening for type 1 diabetes risk, and he will share with us some data from a very important international study called the TEDDY study. Dr. Gopian, please.
Thank you very much. And it's great to speak after Dr. Sasinka, since he's done so much great work in this field. What I'm considering is testing and detecting prediabetes even earlier than what Dr. Sasinka has talked about. And it's becoming very well known from a number of general population studies that once kids have multiple islet autoantibodies, that more than 80% go on to get the disease during childhood. So predicting the disease earlier than when metabolic abnormalities occur, and predicting the disease in the whole population rather than just first-degree relatives of current diabetes patients is sort of what we're after here. And it's a big undertaking, so I'm not going to mince words on that. There's logistics involved, costs involved, and ethics. We don't have an FDA-approved therapy to offer these kids. But I believe there is an ethical benefit. There's less DKA at onset of disease, less hospitalization. There are published studies showing both of these when kids participate in an autoantibody surveillance program for prediction of diabetes ahead of the disease. And the most important thing that I think this can offer is sort of a little bit of a speculative idea, but I think it's probably accurate, and that is immunotherapies work differently at different stages of disease. And some of the immunotherapies that aren't working when tested at onset of hyperglycemia may well work very well when applied before that. And that's, I think, an idea that TrialNet has embraced and an idea that I embrace as well, with the idea that maybe we can provide greater numbers of cohorts, greater cohorts of kids to be able to test these therapies on if we can access the much greater number of prediabetes cases in the general population versus those in first-degree relatives. So the paradigm is HLA testing followed by autoantibody testing, and how to apply this is the question. And the TEDDY study, which is actually designed to determine environmental triggers of type 1 diabetes, provides a really good model of how you would HLA screen general populations, which we don't exclude first-degree relatives, but most of the kids that we screen don't have a first-degree relative with disease. And I think we've HLA typed 421,000 kids at six centers, three in Europe, three in the U.S., for TEDDY, and have followed then intensively 8,600 kids. So we follow them and test for autoantibodies, islet autoantibodies, as one of the endpoints of the study. So this is a perfect model for HLA screening followed by autoantibody surveillance in the population. And you can sort of use the experience for TEDDY to figure out sort of approaches to the other barriers, one of which, a great one, is cost. If we apply the frequency of testing that's done in TEDDY, it costs $15,000 per patient identified, which is more than the money that would be saved by warning them about DKA, decreasing hospitalizations. So a key effort is to make the immunogenetic testing less expensive. And so I go into that in my talk as well. But I think we're getting to the stage where it's almost break-even cost-wise versus medical savings-wise for DKA and admission. And that provides a great excuse to get large cohorts of kids to test immunotherapies before a diagnosis. Only by testing before a diagnosis in cohorts of kids are we going to find a prevention therapy and get to that FDA approval stage. Thanks.
So questions, and while people are raising or getting ready to raise their hand, just to clarify, this is screening from birth, I think. Just to clarify that, I'm not sure that was clear to the audience.
Teddy followed the kids, screened them at birth, and the first test for autoantibodies was at 3 months of age. So the diabetes occurs pretty early. It's kind of a plateau of annual incidence from age 2 to age 14. And so it would be important to start very early with these predictive tests. And, of course, you know, your genes are with you for your whole life, so it's particularly convenient to test at the newborn period. And we use newborn screening blood spots to do the HLA genetic test. Then the autoantibody tests have to be done periodically on blood that's actively collected because they turn at some point from negative to positive in kids that are destined to get diabetes. So it starts out at birth but follows them for many years.
And what is so particularly important about this study, as you heard Dr. Gopian say, it is really to try to understand what are the environmental factors or triggers that may be interacting with the genetic susceptibility to autoimmunity that leads to type 1 diabetes. So if I could ask you to just share with the audience, what are some of the environmental factors that you're tracking over time?
Okay. Well, we're tracking a whole lot of things. We're tracking intense measures of dietary exposures, including diuresis and recall. We're tracking biomarkers of those same dietary vitamins and fatty acids, and so we're using databases to break down the composition of all the foods that are identified by specific brand and preparation to be able to tell the exact nutrient intake. We're also collecting stool samples once a month from age 3 months. We have collected. As well as nasal swabs and blood, of course, where you can detect viruses. But we're analyzing the stool for both viruses and bacteria, and we're analyzing the blood for bacteria and viruses as well by genetic methods to try to determine exposures. We're measuring psychosocial exposures such as and stress using biomarkers such as salivary cortisol. We're measuring activity by accelerometers. We're measuring BMI and body mass. And we're also doing extensive questionnaires about exposures such as preschool, pets, allergies, medications, and illnesses. So it's a pretty comprehensive study, and the data is overwhelming. We're also taking the samples and doing omics types of analysis on them. We're doing SNP analysis of primary DNA sequence across the genome using immunochips. We're doing gene expression studies in detail on samples taken every 3 months from these kids. And we're also doing metabolomics and proteomics. So we're going to have incredible layers of complicated data to analyze to try to determine what environmental triggers are causing type 1 diabetes. But in my talk later today, I'm not really going into that. I'm talking about population-based prediction of disease and the TEDDY model for that. But TEDDY is an impressive study in terms of identifying the environmental triggers as well.
Well, I think we'll move on. It is now my great pleasure to introduce the next speaker is Dr. Jaakko Tumileto, who is the Emeritus Professor of Public Health at the University of Helsinki in Finland. This afternoon, he'll be speaking on epidemiology of type 1 diabetes in low- and middle-income countries. Jaakko, please.
Yeah, thank you very much. Yeah, I come from a country which is very special for type 1 diabetes because we have the highest incidence in Finland in the whole world, far above the other countries. So in our country we have had a lot of interest to do the studies, and so we initiated 20 years ago the World Health Organization with the World Health Organization assistance a global study called Diamond, where we collected the data of the newly diagnosed pediatric cases of type 1 diabetes around the world. So we had more than 100 participating populations in that study, and we followed, we collected data for 10 years during 1990 to 1999. With a very huge number of people or background population included. So we had a variety of countries, variety of populations that we have been looking at. And it has been proposed somehow that type 1 diabetes is a disease which increases with the wealth and hygiene and all kind of things that are in the modern wealthy society, but it is not quite so, because still, if you take another very well developed country, Japan has one of the lowest incidence of diabetes still today, and in that country all these things have happened like in the Western countries. I mean, the economic and educational and social growth and developments. But when we go to the low and middle income countries, which is a current term of previously we spoke about the developing countries, and low and middle income countries around the world, they do exist. Every continent basically has these populations. We cannot see a single pattern at all, because in some low and middle income countries you may have a relatively high risk of type 1 diabetes and in some others very low. And there are many reasons for the variations in incidence and the risk, starting from the genetics that was mentioned here. We know from the data that so-called East Asian Oriental Mongoloid ethnic group is relatively protected against type 1 diabetes because of their genetic makeup, and the rest of the world is basically the same. We have seen now from data from Africa that confirm that the Africans they also may have almost similar incidence of diabetes than the white Europeans. And the same happens with the South Asians, who are actually also the Caucasian people, like Europeans, but living in a different environment and may look slightly different than white Europeans. But the risk in these people, especially in the UK, we have a lot of data from several investigators that have looked at the immigrants from South Asian populations to the UK, and they have almost a similar risk of getting a disease than the people in white Europeans living in the UK. So I said that the genetic is one thing, but the other thing, of course, in the low and middle income countries is the survival, and the third is quality of care, and we'll hear more about the quality of care. But the survival is quite important in type 1 diabetes. Basically, if you get the disease before the age of reproduction, your family line stops there. You are not transmitting your genetic information to the to the next generation, as it happens in the most cases now in the more developed countries. The most recent data, for instance, from Finland and Sweden, show that the number of offspring in women with type 1 diabetes is approximately the same as in a non-diabetic population today. But it wasn't that in the past for many reasons, for complications, for maternal mortality and so on. So the things have been changing in the developed countries, but in the low and middle income countries, people are still struggling financially to have a care. And then comes the misdiagnosis, especially in children. If you go to a poor environments in where the gastrointestinal diseases are common, you may think that a child has some sort of infection when the child is vomiting and getting weak and so on. So people may have a lot of misdiagnosis also, and that's how then the disease frequency stays artificially lower than compared with the more developed populations. So I'm going to present some sort of a documentation, what is available and what is not available. The one thing which is very unfortunate, after our Diamond project ended 10 years ago, only very few countries have kept the registries for type 1 diabetes, including this particular country here. Only in a very few places we know what is happening today. And this is a pity because it is relatively easy to monitor the childhood onset type 1 diabetes, but governments and so on are not funding that sort of activities, which is very, very unfortunate. And most unfortunate it is for the low and middle income countries where we are lacking data.
Questions from the audience. It's very important to be identifying the youth developing type 1 diabetes in all countries throughout the world, particularly the low and middle income, because even in the first world countries, highly developed countries, rates of DKA at onset are between 25 and 40%, and DKA at onset can be a lethal condition. So rates even in developed countries are too high, so you can imagine how high they are in the low and middle income. Just one question I have. If you're saying a lot of the rates of type 1 diabetes may be similar in some of these low and middle income countries, but when some of the inhabitants of the low and middle income countries emigrate to, for example, Finland or Sweden, which have higher rates, what do you see in terms of changing incidence rates?
Well, not really. Usually, the information is such that the disease rate remains approximately the same than it was in the country of origin. But there are, of course, some differences, especially, as I said, that in the country of origin it's sometimes very difficult to find out what is a real incidence of the disease. So it looks like that some people who have moved from low and middle income countries to a more advanced country, they do have increased risk of type 1 diabetes. But to my understanding, most of it is an artifact and not real.
I think we'll go to the final speaker because that may answer some of the questions about management. So it is my pleasure now to introduce Dr. John Yudkin, who is the Emeritus Professor of Medicine at the University College in London and Chairman of the International Insulin Foundation. This afternoon, his talk will be on healthcare delivery for type 1 diabetes in the low and middle income countries. Please join us.
Thank you. I'm going to be talking about one of the points that Jaakko made, which is that the incidence of type 1 diabetes in many low-income countries is very similar to what it is in the UK or the US, but the number of people with type 1 diabetes is very low, and that's because they die. And studies that we've done have suggested that if you're born, if you develop type 1 diabetes as a child in rural Mozambique, your life expectancy is around 1.5 years. That's similar to what it was like in Boston before the advent of insulin. The Joslin Clinic has a very good documentation of what happened to life expectancy for young people with diabetes through the 1910s and 20s. And there was this dramatic increase in life expectancy as soon as insulin became available. And the important point is that people in many countries have got a life expectancy with their type 1 diabetes similar to what it was in the US 90 years ago. And we have established a foundation called the International Insulin Foundation to do research on this and have done surveys using a specially developed rapid assessment protocol for, we call it a RAPI, a rapid assessment protocol for insulin access, which we've done in Mozambique and in Zambia and in Mali and in Nicaragua and in Vietnam and in Kyrgyzstan to try and identify the barriers to diabetes care. Insulin cost was one of the major barriers. Insulin generally costs somewhere between $5 and $10 a vial in these low-income countries, sometimes up to $20, and that means that that's $150 a year for a family whose income is on average $1 a day, $360 a year. So in many countries, it costs 5 months' income to buy the insulin for survival. And for that reason, in many countries, a child who develops type 1 diabetes and then dies proves a financial relief to the family. But it's not just the cost of insulin, it's the delivery of insulin to the places where the people live and the other package of things that's necessary for good health care for a person with type 1 diabetes. There's a sort of health systems package that you need, which includes health workers and facilities and referral systems and testing kits. And all of these things have become very obvious with HIV/AIDS, where there are 42 million people worldwide with the condition. Type 1 diabetes in low-income countries doesn't have the sort of population impact of that, so one can't, as far as the major global organizations are concerned, prioritize it in the same way as HIV/AIDS, because it's hundreds of thousands of people rather than millions. But we in our foundation have been exploring ways of improving healthcare in these low-income countries to improve outcome. One of the major barriers, as I say, is the cost of insulin, and that is largely to do with the fact that insulin globally comes over 95% from the three major manufacturers. They have a powerful market control, which in turn has a major impact on price. And what we are now doing and working with the World Health Organization to do is to develop high-quality generic insulin from good manufacturers that could be scaled up to sell at a much lower cost than the $5 to $10 a bottle that it currently costs. In Brazil, they're now producing insulin, generic human insulin, at $1.80 a vial, and this makes possible the much more cost-effective management of insulin. In my talk, I'm going to be talking about needs assessment, about ways of improving healthcare delivery, and about the campaign that is going on with WHO and our International Insulin Foundation to produce quality-assured generic insulin.
Question, please. Microphone to the front. While you're bringing the microphone, let me just ask you, while you mentioned that we're talking in terms of hundred thousands of patients with type 1 diabetes compared to the 42 million you mentioned with HIV/AIDS, I guess I would suspect it really is millions of patients if there wasn't the premature mortality among the youth diagnosed. If you think about it, most people in first world countries, particularly the United States and other first world countries, the greatest proportion of individuals with type 1 diabetes are in fact adults. While it's most common for type 1 to be diagnosed in youth, most patients with type 1 diabetes are adults, and that's the depot of people that are being lost in these countries. So can you speculate the numbers?
Yeah, it's impossible to answer. The International Diabetes Federation Atlas provides numbers of diabetes patients in countries around the world and does a sort of guesstimate of type 1, type 2. We did an exercise that we published in The Lancet about 12 years ago now for the 40 heavily indebted poor countries where we used the Diabetes Atlas figures and then worked out the cost of how much it would be to provide free insulin to all of these people with type 1 diabetes in these 40 low-income countries. It came to $3 million a year. And we also estimated that if these people were to live five times longer because they had treatment for their diabetes, how much would it cost then? $15 million a year.
Sounds affordable, doesn't it? Question? You had a microphone, please.
Lynn Peterson with Trends in Medicine. So, I'm sorry, I was listening to your last comment, and you're not talking about generic insulin. Are you talking about biosimilars?
Yeah.
So I thought the only biosimilar right now is one that Lilly is working on. Are there others?
We're talking about the definition of biosimilar I find complex. These are human insulin. I think if it's a produced by non-chemical methods, in other words, biosynthetic insulin, it's by definition a biosimilar. There are a number of manufacturers around the world who produce human insulin that's genetically engineered and which has passed the drug approval bodies in not only those countries, but in the countries they export to, many of which are middle-income or high-income countries. So there are virtually all of China, human insulin is made in China. There are products, there's production of human insulin in Egypt, in Brazil, and in Poland. By your definition, yes, I'm sorry, these would be called biosimilars, but they are genetically engineered human insulin. Nobody's as yet talking about analog insulin as biosimilars.
There's just a need for availability of insulin, human insulin, not even the analog insulin. I think if you could expand that, human insulin, not even the analog, either rapid or long-acting, it's just the need for insulin, and those are the ones you're discussing, if I understand you.
Yeah, regular and MPH insulin.
Any other questions? Well, I want to make sure we thank the panel and give everyone time to get to the talk. And let me just remind you that that the talk is entitled this ADA and JDRF Symposium. Very important that American Diabetes Association and Juvenile Diabetes Foundation are working together on this symposium, which is entitled Global Epidemiology of Type 1 Diabetes and Implications for Public Health. And it'll be very exciting. I'm looking forward to hearing the four of you speak this afternoon. Thank you.